Blog Talk Radio.
Bonjour mes amis, ça va bien. Oh, I hope we're all ça va bien-ing tonight. It's Monday and you're listening to Come Now, Don't Sulk, our wonderful live podcast every week here as part of the Here Be Monsters studio, and we're on Blog Talk Radio Network, and I'm here with my wonderful producer. By the way, I'm Sybil Brunson, for those of you whose memories may be going, like mine. And speaking of memories going, I have my producer here, and she's under a doctor's care right now. She's been given her piece of whiskey, as we like to say in the South, but she's being given it IV now. Now, it's no longer appropriate for her to drink, but she is literally being given whiskey through an IV situation, and we have a hospital staff standing by. How could we do the show without our wonderful producer and our head chemist, Gwendolyn Holdenberry? Gwendolyn, how are you tonight? All right. Well, as you're chuckling, I'm going to just remind people that Gwendolyn is the founder of daughtersofisis.com. That's daughtersofisis.com, all one word, the fragrant memories of our ancestors. And by listeners just like you, thank you. And by the way, if you'd like to advertise on our show or be one of our sponsors, do contact us, because we do have other sponsors other than daughtersofisis.com, but we do depend on them. And remember, you can check out their website during the show on your laptop or later after the show and check out their amazing products. Speaking of which, Gwendolyn is the founder of daughtersofisis.com. Gwendolyn, as the head chemist and fragrantologist there, do you have a fragrance for us now that we're leaving March and we're about to enter April? Is there something that would be just absolutely wonderful for our noses and our psyches?
Well, I do. I have one that's a little bit a little spicy, but very calming and very wise. It's called the Medicine Woman. It's from my Peruvian shamanic blends. And it's about bringing the grandmother into your presence, but also being revived and healthy and having a clarity of purpose going into the big sunny days and the confidence to heal not just ourselves, but our communities. It revives, too. It's a blend of immortal and liquid amber with a really nice pimento berry. I always like using pimento berries.
It does. So that makes it the spicy. That's the spicy element, right?
Yeah. It's got some rose attar in it and some nice cedar leaves and a little bit of very rich patchouli. So it's grounding, but not too. It takes you up, but it takes you into your own heart. So that's the wise woman. And the flower essence that I put into it, which is a homeopathic vibrational essence, is actually white lilac, which is a renewal of our innocence. And it brings about trust, and it's also thought of to be the grandmother flower essence. So it all comes together.
Speaking of lilac, on the spectrum of fragrance, lilac, how does white lilac differ from the other lilac scents? Can you describe for the home audience how the lilacs are different? Because my grandmother grew lilacs that were like 25 feet high. Her lilacs were notorious in the neighborhood, and literally they were like trees. And my grandmother, being a New Englander, was ruthless with her lilacs. She hired people to come in and go up on huge ladders and prune her lilacs so that they would be absolutely enormous with flowers. That's the secret of lilacs, is you have to really be ruthless with them. You can't let them get all spindly and leggy and falling over and, you know, wimpy. You've got to keep them like really healthy and robust. And she would do that. And her lilacs would literally, I mean, she would have hundreds of blooms all over them. And she had, what she loved was an assortment of lilacs. So she had like 20 different colors of lilacs. So can you describe for the home audience how a white lilac differs from a magenta one or a true blue purple or a grape purple or a royal purple? How do they differ?
Well, the roses often will have a similarity in fragrance, whereas the lilac, like the white lilac, is sort of tangy to your nose, but just as cloying and just as perfumed. It's a sweetness that has a tang to it, where the, say, the robust blue-purple are just overwhelmingly cloying and robust in scent, and they're like a common stream that flows through. They're like the grandmother because they're basically common stream that flows through all lilac scent. Yet each lilac, it's like a Lincoln lilac, smells a lot different. Well, not a lot different, but it has its own fragrance that's lilac and cloying, but it's more fresh than sweet.
So the fragrance we're looking for on daughtersofisis.com is called the Medicine Woman. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. It's in the sprays and mists.
That's wonderful. I happen to think that lilac is a wonderful fragrance, and even when it is heavy and cloying, and even when it, like, when you smell it in a neighborhood and you can smell it like from three houses down, I think it's a wonderful smell. It's just wonderful.
It is. I used to wake up in New York in my house. I had white lilacs, huge ones, lining the property in the back. And then by my bedroom window and my kitchen window, I had the blue-purple ones that I just had a lot of scent coming. I was overwhelmed by it my first year there. I was surprised by it.
I'm wondering about buying maybe a lilac bush for the front of our little house here in the suburbs of Philadelphia. You know, I'm wondering if I might splurge on one and put it in this little strip garden. We've got literally like a strip of land between our driveway and the driveway next door. If it's 12 feet wide, I don't even think it's that wide. It might be 12, but I thought I might put a lilac bush in there and obviously not let it grow to 20 feet in height, but keep it short and muscular and really intense. But I thought it might be a wonderful addition to this. Anyway, so folks at home, daughtersofisis.com, our sponsors, do make sure that you go online and check out their fragrance tonight, their fragrance du jour, is Medicine Woman, and they have over 500 products on their website. So do check them out. Wonderful products to expand your sensual, your metaphysical, your psychological, your spiritual, all of those things. Make sure that you check out their products tonight. We have a caller who's already called in. Oh, by the way, I have to remember. Would you like to call in and talk to Gwendolyn and me and to our special guest tonight? Our phone number is 323-784-9639. I'll give you just a second to pull out your Crayola crayon. Pick a nice color like cinnabar or bonfire smoke or fresh pus or something like that. 323-784-9639. That's 323-784-9639. And write down that phone number and call us. Wayne, are you on the line with us right now?
I am.
Great. Ladies and gentlemen at home, Wayne is one of our frequent visitors. As you know, Mummy is coming to you from the mainline towns outside of Philadelphia now that I've left New York. And Gwendolyn is coming to you from Port St. Lucie. And Wayne, where are you calling from?
I am in downtown historic Annapolis is where I live.
Annapolis. So one of us is coming from a state capital, which is very exciting. Very exciting. And I'm sure that he's got something that he's going to tell us about that. But before we start, I just want to, first of all, I always say, let's talk about what you'd like to talk about. Now, I have some topics here, and some people private message me. I don't know why my listeners insist on private messaging me, but they don't call in and ask questions or talk. They just say, oh, mommy, can you talk about cookies this week, or can you talk about a found pet?
Somebody else is calling in. Shall we see who it is?
Well, let's take them. Hello, caller.
Hello.
Who's this?
Hello. This is Kim from Kansas.
Kim from Kansas. Oh, Kim, it's wonderful to hear your voice. Kim, you're on tonight with Wayne Johnson, too. For those of you at home, Kimberly is literally, she has not been sainted yet, but she will be soon enough by the Catholic Church. She is literally the patron saint of all plants and flowers. She can bring anything back to life. And she has gardens which make the Garden of Eden look like a dump. She is just when she posts photographs, I've gotten word from St. Michael that the Blessed Savior and God himself gnash their teeth and begin breaking furniture in heaven because they're so furious that Kim has better garden stuff than them. She is a wonder worker. She can raise carrots and tulips. It's whatever. Kim, we're opening the subjects tonight so that you and Wayne, can you bring up something and we'll talk about whatever it is you want to talk about tonight. I've been asked a couple of questions, but I don't need to go to those questions tonight. So, Wayne, why don't we let's let ladies go first, even though that's
absolutely.
No, let
Wayne.
Kim, what do you feel like chatting about tonight?
I just heard you talking about lilac, so that pricked my ears up, and my blood root was blooming today, so that was kind of exciting. It's white.
Oh, nice.
That's great. Now, Kim, you're in Kansas, which is what zone is that? Is that zone 4 or zone 5?
It's 6A, 5B, kind of. I'm on the cusp.
Right. Because in New York, I used to be in Zone 6, and I don't know where I am now outside of Philadelphia. And, of course, with global warming, we're all going to be Zone 12 soon enough. I mean, how much longer before you're going to be raising pineapples in your backyard at the rate we're going? But how's is your garden not blooming necessarily, but you certainly have all of your bulbs are coming up to the ground at this point, aren't they?
Yeah, I have several bulbs coming up, and I can see I've got iris fans that are starting to emerge, and of course they'll be blooming in May. That'll be a while, but I can see their growth, so that's fun.
And you're in charge of your entire garden. So when you moved there, you planted, what, 90% of what your garden is, or did you inherit tons of stuff from the former owner of your place?
I didn't inherit anything in the back. It was all turf. So everything in the back I've either brought with me or planted since I came here. So, yeah, it was all grass. That was it. All I had. One bush and the rest was grass. So.
Well, in my situation, like I said, I've got two strips in front of my now house. So I've got this strip from the front door to the street. And I've got a strip from, and that's between my driveway and theirs. And then the neighbor next to mine, we're in townhouses. So the strip next to me is only about 24 inches wide or 36 inches wide. And that's from the garage door to the street. So I've inherited a bunch of like foundlings, like irises that have gone crazy, which are coming up through the ground, and a very poorly taken care of bougainvillea or something. I mean, it just, like really, I mean, I'm looking out at it now, and of course the cold temperatures we're getting 30 degree weather tonight again. So it's like all of my new plants are saying, what the hell is going on here? Wayne, are you much of a gardener?
I did at one time. I was more of the planting the trees, the floral trees. One thing I did notice here this past weekend, before I bought the condo here in Annapolis, I had a 56-acre farm. I formerly landscaped 3 acres around the 4,000-square-foot home that I had there. The lane was like a third of a mile long, so I had a whole buffer of trees, and you couldn't see it from the road and things like that. It was my own little sanctuary enclave. But in
that's
that,
lovely.
I had a bunch of, oh, it was in, planted a lot of the flowering pears, aristocratic Bradford pears, that kind of stuff, that lined the lane.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, at this time of year, you know, when the fruit trees and, of course, the flowering kind of trees were in bloom, my driveway or the lane was just lined with these pom-poms of white, mature Bradford pears and aristocratic pears.
And of course, with pear trees, they come in male and female. So it's good that you have multiple pears. People don't realize they can't plant one pear tree and then have pear. You've got to have several pear trees so they can cross-pollinate and produce fruit.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, of course, I had some real true fruit-bearing pears so that all of these trees and the bees were having a fiesta orgy throughout the whole thing.
Oh, wonderful. I happen to adore bees. Yeah.
Oh,
no,
absolutely. Look, we would not exist without bees, period.
Exactly.
They are the
You know, it's funny, Mark Twain, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, said that when the bees go, the human race will go. And it's like even then people knew, and certainly sophisticated people like Mark Twain, knew that the world depended on pollinators, and not just birds and not just butterflies, but the biggest workhorses in the entire animal kingdom are bees.
Absolutely.
They are absolutely this little tiny insect, which I happen to find them beautiful, all their different
species.
They're so pretty to look at, and there's nothing that makes me happier. I actually get emotional about it. I love watching bees work in my garden. Is there anything on earth that is more earnest or more focused and heartfelt? You watch a bee working, and they are just, there's something saintly about them to me. If people doubt if there is a supreme being, watch bees working in flowers and watch them talking to each other. Watch them bickering about things. Watch bees bicker over a blossom, like, you know, and they start to quarrel about it. Or they talk about something and then they go off. But you watch all of those little bees. And, of course, what I love also is that all bees are girls. They happen to be not they're not fertile.
Mm-hmm.
But most people don't realize that all the bees you're seeing are girls. They're young ladies, and they are working around the clock. I mean, they're priceless, just priceless to watch. And, Kim, do you love watching bees in your garden?
I do, and for the first time, I'm going to try to raise solitary native bees, and I've just gotten my supplies and ordered the bees to try that this year for the first time.
Oh, my God.
The solitary bees don't make honey, of course, but, you know, honey bees are not native. Anyway, they don't take as much. I think I can still work full-time and do that. They pretty much take care of themselves. You just have to provide a habitat and have enough flowers for them. But I'm really excited about it. They only live about – the spring ones only live about 6 weeks, and they lay about 10 to 20 eggs apiece in that time, and then they'll put a little pollen ball with that egg, and it hibernates over the winter and then emerges next spring. So, and then I'm going to get leaf cutter bees for summer. I'm very excited about that. So follow me that, and I'll be posting some things about that as that happens. But
You just informed me. I didn't know that honeybees were not native to North America. I guess they were. I know that there was. They found, like, ancient, you know, in clay jars in ancient Egypt honey. But is that where
they
originally come from?
About 1620, from Southeast Asia. And the other interesting thing is solitary bees, which they take care of themselves. They don't have a colony. That's why they're called solitary bees. There's lots of different species. But they are much better pollinators than honeybees because honeybees are much more efficient at gathering pollen because they need to they gather it and they bring it back. They don't waste it, whereas solitary bees are very messy, and so they're really great pollinators. They say about 80 to 100 to 1. One solitary bee can do the work of about 80 to 100 because the honeybees are so much more
My goodness, I didn't know that, Kim. That's wonderful. That's
this show is educational, too. It's not only entertaining, but educational. We should have the big E put on there. When you see this symbol, this means it's educational.
Well, I work with flowers. That's my gig. And you know what?
Yeah.
I just got an education too. But I knew about the solitary. I knew they were there. I just thought I didn't know enough, did I?
And they're very, very friendly, and they don't really have the time or the energy to sting you because they're busy gathering their pollen because they're not very, like I said, they're not very efficient at it. They're very messy, and they strew it everywhere, which is good for pollination. And then as they get, takes them lots and lots of trips to gather enough for that little ball to put with their egg, and then they, like I said, they lay, you know, 10 to 20 per season. They only live 6 weeks, and that's their purpose.
That's fabulous.
Bee venom is very healing.
I'm looking up right now. I saw a program recently on advertising kits that were available that you can get, and you can raise your own solitary bees. And here it's called Humble Bee. Yes. Hold on 1 second. I've got it. On Amazon, they've got it. Solitary bees sold direct on eBay. They show these cute little mason bee houses. It's called a mason bee. And they have cute little bee houses that you put out. And the bees will go in there. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. Go on the internet and enter solitary bees. And you can enter solitary bees kits. And it has all of these sites that you can go to, and it's wonderful.
On Crown Bees is where I order my stuff. They have lots and lots of videos on YouTube, and they have lots of educational information before you order your supplies. The leaf cutter bees are a summertime during the summer months, so that's what I ordered, and they actually cut out. Won't be cutting out little circles out of my lilac leaves, but that's okay. And then they plug their little holes up to protect their egg and make a little cocoon, like a little vault, I guess you'd say, for their eggs with the leaves from the clay. So, anyway, I'm done, but I wanted to share that because I knew that you would be excited about that.
Yeah, I think that's fabulous. And believe me, if I had land, it's my fantasy sometime to have an estate, I would also be raising, I would have like beehives. I'd do it all. I would have like it be like a complete nature preserve because I think one of my biggest fantasies would be if I ever had money, I would love to have land that I would let go completely wild and have it be a haven for all species. And certainly I would be nurturing things that I really love, like bees, hummingbirds. I would be doing all of it. As it is, I put out a quote-unquote, and I think you might have seen the Tourette this week. I put out a squirrel-proof feeder that cost me $55, and I put it out
that.
In my front strip, and the squirrels are literally climbing this cute little boxwood that was nearly dying. I pruned it all and turned it sort of into a bonsai tree. I cleaned out so much dead growth in it that it now looks like a bonsai tree. Actually, my neighbors think it's quite extraordinary looking. And I hung a bird feeder in it, and the squirrels immediately descended on it. A male and female cardinal did too, and my sparrows. I have no pigeons, thank God. But squirrels are getting in it and climbing up in the branches. And what's hysterical is I loaded it full of red pepper flakes and cayenne, and my squirrels apparently are, I don't know, they're either Mexican or they're margarita drunk, but they literally are inhaling the bird seeds that are literally red with cayenne pepper. The bird seed mix that I put in there and shook up with red pepper flakes and cayenne, they are literally, the seeds are now red, and these squirrels are inhaling them while the Google site says that squirrels are frantic about getting away from it, that they have been known to gnaw their paws off trying to get rid of the sensation of, well, I don't know what's going on in my front yard, but I have a tequila party going on there. The only thing that hasn't happened, they haven't hung a piñata and hit it with sticks yet. I mean, it's literally, there's maracas and castanets and, you know, Juan Gabriel is singing songs in my front yard. I mean, what is going on? It's like I may as well serve them the tacos and chimichangas. It's like, what is going on out there? So I don't know what to do next. I guess I'm going to get squirrel spray. But my squirrels are the size of, like, Victor Buono right now. I mean, they put on, like, 30 pounds apiece on these bird seeds that I've fed them. So but it's wonderful nurturing nature. And, you know, and, yes, squirrels are tree rats, as they're jokingly called. I happen to love squirrels, but I didn't think
Same
that
here.
I wanted them to displace all the birds.
So,
Kim, do you have any advice on that?
Go
Kim, maybe you know about that.
I don't. My squirrels eat my bird seed, too. My nemesis is the rabbits, though. They eat a lot of things that I'd like to grow, and they eat them as soon as they start sprouting, and they make me very angry.
Do you do deer repellent? So you don't do deer repellent, deer and rabbit repellent, or anything like that?
No. I don't. I have done cayenne. It didn't seem to work for me either. I bought 5 pounds of it on Amazon.
Gee whiz. Gee whiz.
One of those, you know, like restaurant size shaker. It's a 5-pound thing of cayenne, and I bought that to sprinkle around. And, yeah, it mostly just blew in my eyes one day, and I haven't done it since.
It's funny you said that, because I made the mistake, and I'm a good cook. I made the mistake of taking out an entire bottle of Durkee's cayenne or whatever it was. I mean, so this is an expensive hobby, because I just took a big bottle of spice out there and red pepper flakes, which are pricey, and I dumped them in the bird feeder, and I got it on my hands, and I was watching and waiting for the squirrels to, you know, climb up on the feeder, eat some, and then, like, be horrified and run. Meanwhile, they're not horrified. They're, like, they became delirious. They became glassy-eyed with ecstasy. It was like it was sex to them. And then I made the mistake of touching my own eyes, and I got cayenne in my eyes and had to go into the bathroom and wash my eyes out. So it's just like, I guess I'm relieved that it's, you know, after sunset, the party sort of ends, although, I mean, they're going as late as 6 o'clock at night, so they're not there now, but my God. And the birds are, like, giving me the dirtiest looks, like, what the hell are you doing, Sybil? You know, Mummy, for God's sakes, why don't you just bring a pitcher of margaritas out here for these drunks, you know, these bushy-tailed drunks? So I guess I'm going to go to the gardening center and see if they really do have a deer repellent spray that the birds won't mind, but that the squirrels and rabbits and, you know, everything, whatever. We'll see.
I have a question for you.
What is it? Yeah.
Like, you know, of course, we know that there's the typical gray squirrel, but we're noting a lot here in Maryland, especially where I am at, black squirrels. In other words, they're just like black kitty cats.
Oh, wow.
And I have a friend down in the Appalachian Mountains of North Carolina, and they have all white squirrels. We're not talking albino. We are talking white bird, right?
Yeah.
And it's illegal to hunt them, you know, because of their kind of uniqueness of them, right? And so I didn't know if you had diversification there where you are some or not.
Well, because Pennsylvania has been observing voter rights, we do have some black squirrels. And I'm sure that if Georgia continues its mischief, we will have huge influxes of black squirrels moving northward into Maryland and then on up into Pennsylvania, which I look forward to. I look forward to seeing white squirrels, but of course I won't tolerate any mischief from them. And I certainly won't be interested in them going and taking down my clothes, my fresh laundry lines in the back and stealing our bed sheets.
Oh, my.
I happen to love red squirrels. The famous red squirrels of Europe are beautiful, and I have a needlepoint pillow that I did have a red squirrel. They have the wonderful pointy ears. They're a little more demonic looking, than a gray squirrel. You know, I happen to love squirrels, and I can't imagine eating them. It seems like it would be like, oh, for heaven's sakes, you have to be really desperate to eat squirrel. First of all, what is it? It's like you've got a thimble full of meat on those bones,
yeah.
No matter how much bird seed they've eaten. I mean, to me, a squirrel is even more forlorn than a Cornish game hen,
My editor served me squirrel stew one night. I said, this is different. And she said, I was, oh, my God. But my editor, I love her dearly to this day. Hummingbirds would come and nearly land on her and be around her. Foxes would come out of the woods and come right up to her. She was amazing. She had a gift with animals, but she also knew the cycle of life. And you grow up in the mountains of North Carolina, you know how to, swing down a squirrel or two and put it in a stew pot with vegetables if you got to feed the family. So,
wow. I would think that shooting a squirrel would probably annihilate most of the meat on that little carcass. You know, it's like, for heaven's sakes, who can shoot a squirrel?
Oh, no, they trap them. They would trap them. I have a huge squirrel community on the tree outside my bedroom window. And we're blessed with some really wonderful Florida oak and maple here. And they're just huge. Not great for hurricane season, but the thing is that the squirrels love those trees and they live in them. They got little communities going. They're up at night.
Of course.
Because I have an tropical elephant plant that's twisted around the trunk of it with the big leaves coming off. So the squirrels are scattering up and down all night long through the leaves.
Wow.
And I hear what they're up to. Sometimes I talk to them. I've named a couple.
That's funny. I have a question. Kim, do you raise vegetables as well? Do you grow vegetables?
No, I don't.
I just can't do that. I don't know. Even if I had lots of land, I tried to grow vegetables when I was very young. My grandmother, encouraged me. And, I mean, we just lost vegetables to everything. We lost them to rabbits. We lost them to blight. You know, it was like the insect world and the rodent world and the disease world decimated everything I ever grew. The only thing I ever successfully grew were pumpkins, and that was kind of fun. I mean, they didn't become gigantic pumpkins, but I had pumpkin vines that grew up, and I was fascinated. I was very little, and I thought, that was the first time that I realized that you could grow something. I was four. And, my grandmother, showed me that we planted the pumpkin seeds and watered them every day. And sure enough, within about a week, little green shoots came up, and I was transfixed. That was the beginning of that whole thing. It was the rain in Spain moment. It was the aha moment where I associated those seeds with life. And it was an extraordinary moment, where I went, this is that thing that happens. And I've been addicted ever since, but I've never been tempted to grow vegetables. And I know that tomatoes off a vine are life-changing. I mean, I've tasted other people's tomatoes. People have handed me tomatoes from their garden, and nothing compares to tomatoes, any species, whether it's an heirloom or it's a hybrid, whatever, cherry tomatoes, grape tomatoes, whatever. You pull a tomato off a vine and get it into your mouth within 5 minutes, and you will never be the same again. So it's just, grocery store tomatoes pale by comparison. By the way, home viewers, and I know that everyone will agree with me on this, of my panel tonight, my wonderful celebrity panel, never, ever, ever refrigerate a tomato. Okay, that's an old piece of grandma wisdom. Never put a tomato in the refrigerator. And if you are shopping for tomatoes and you go to a grocery store that has them in a refrigerator or has them in a chilled environment, do not buy them, because the chemicals that make those flavonoids are very vulnerable. If the temperature drops below about 50 degrees, the flavor is already gone. So it's not the same with tomato sauce that you cooked. and then you put it in the refrigerator. You've anchored the flavors, basically. But a fresh tomato of any species goes into a refrigerator, ba-boom, you've killed it. So just remember that, okay?
I didn't know that.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yep, and it's funny because I love Cherry Grove, Fire Island, and our grocer out there, Reggie, is brilliant, and he's a real foodie, but he insists on putting his tomatoes into the refrigerator area, and they're dead. They're completely dead. They're flavorless. So remember that when you buy tomatoes, use them. Leave them out. And use them. It's a
okay.
very fragile vegetable. You can't, you know, a tomato from the store, you can't let it hang out on the counter for very long. If it's greenish and you want to ripen it, get it in the sun, but you've got to, you sort of have to use them. That's why you're also supposed to buy tomatoes. And if you can buy them on the vine, so sometimes you'll buy a pack of tomatoes and they'll be on the vine. That keeps them going a little longer,
mm-hmm.
even though they've
mm-hmm.
cut the vine. Those tomatoes will last a little bit longer because they're still sort of being fed from the vine. But once a tomato is off its vine, the clock is running. And if you put it in the refrigerator thinking you're going to save it, you will kill at least half of the flavor, if not all of it. It's very true. So just try it. That's why buy a tomato if you can from a farmer's market, you know, from a roadside stand. Buy them and then eat them right away and see what it is. Tomatoes also are very complex because there are tomatoes that are like a beefsteak tomato is wonderful in a salad, but cooking it is sort of no. San Marzano mm-hmm. tomatoes are the ultimate, and buy them in cans and make sure it says San Marzano. Those tomatoes that are grown in lava in the
oh,
soil
really?
That usually is volcanic. Oh, yeah.
yeah
so
yeah.
from Naples. You're talking about like the most wonderful soil for grapes, for wine, for tomatoes,
yeah.
for all sorts of things. The Italians have a relationship with food because they have been killed by the thousands by their volcanoes. So they've sacrificed their lives for their food. And tomatoes are, the San Marzano tomatoes are truly the most wonderful tomatoes. They come in Cento? And then the other red pack San Marzano tomatoes. You get those tomatoes. You won't believe them. And cook with those. Canned tomatoes are wonderful. They're picked and then they're sealed in cans. It's one of those vegetables that really does work as a preserved, or not preserved, but as a canned thing. It's like the way vegetables that are frozen, corn and peas and lima beans and broccoli. Those vegetables are picked fresh and then frozen. And those vegetables do survive. They're not vulnerable like a tomato to chill. Anyway, that was enough of that. What else should we talk about, Kim? Wayne, what would you like to talk about tonight?
Oh, my goodness. No. Okay. I guess the only thing that comes to my mind is as far as current events is the finally got that evergreen cargo ship unstuck at the Suez Canal.
Yes, what happened there? Now, tell our homeowner audience what happened there. Where he was parallel parking or something in the Suez Canal and, or the Panama Canal.
Well,
and
it wasn't intentional. Okay. That ship is very, very long. It's like 3 football fields long.
Shocking.
And they have stacked containers, sea
right.
shipping containers, right? That are just, you know, not only in the hall but on the main deck and just keep going up, i.e. like skyscrapers.
Right. Where
there was a large sandstorm or a big wind that caught it in a crosswind, and all those containers on the main deck and above acted like a huge sail, and it blew it aground. A lot of people don't know this, but anytime you go into a port, I was in the Navy, And also I have a very good friend who retired from the Navy and went to a Merchant Marine Academy up in Maine and got his navigation officer's license. So then he went back out and sailed the seven seas and stuff. And anytime you go into port and out of port, you basically turn that ship over to a harbor pilot. They have the license to take a ship up to, say, the Delaware Bay, or or in New York harbors and things like that. And the Suez Canal happens to have their, well, lack of another better term, but there's canal pilots, and they bring their ships in. So that ship wasn't under the control of the captain who sailed it, you know, over the oceans to get it to that point. It was the pilot who came aboard. And these are people who are supposed to be experts and do it all the time. They also have a very large insurance policies for incidences like these, so they are covered. That's why you kind of turn the ship over to them. But that's what happened. Here's somebody that went in and out or through that canal thousands of times. But when you had this big wind catching that large ship with all that containers on there acting like a large sail, she blew her straight to the ground, aground, to the shoreline.
Wow.
And so that's why they were having to dig it all out. They had
so they dug it out. So they didn't have to dismantle the ship the way they did that ocean liner in Italy like 2 years ago, where they literally had to tear the ship apart and dismantle it.
Yes, that was a very good point. That that cruise ship that ran aground, and that was just did not have to do that. And I remember that incident well too, because I in the Navy, I spent some time in Naples and Catania, Sicily, and the southern part of Italy, the boot. And we actually were anchored off Catania, Sicily, where you could see Mount Etna glowing at night and stuff. Because of that lava rock, we got our anchor all caught up in that lava rock, and we ended up having to cut the anchor chain, and they went into Taranto, which is down in the arch of the boot. And they had a salvage ship went down and got that anchor and brought it up there, and it actually twisted the anchor windlass, the big shaft that pulls the chain up, twisted it like a pretzel.
Isn't that amazing?
The
ocean is ruthless. It's like whatever that ocean wants, it gets. You know what I mean? Was the ship in the Suez Canal, was it seriously damaged, or was it basically intact?
It was basically intact.
Hull isn't compromised or anything?
No. I'm sure it'll be – we'll say this. I'm sure they will have a very thorough inspection on it to make sure that no welds were cracked or the parent material cracking next to a weld.
Right.
Before she goes into the med.
Right. It's funny about harbor pilots. I've known about it, and the whole premise of harbor masters and pilots – who take over for an ocean liner or whatever, and they then bring the ship into port because they're more familiar with the, you know, anomalies and the changeable things that can happen, whether it's the Hudson River and an ocean liner coming up that way or whatever, those harbor pilots. Apropos of which, I do enjoy driving, but I hate parking, and I've often wished that I had my own parking lot pilot so that I could drive across the country on the highways, stopping at diners, stopping at little roadside half-moon motels from the 1950s. But whenever I decided to stop somewhere, I would have a nice man who would come out to the car and would parallel park me or three-point park me, and then I would thank him and give him $5 for his niceness. And then when it was time for me to leave in the morning – or after my scrambled eggs and bacon, the nice pilot would, the parking lot pilot would come out. I'd hand him $5 so that I could get out and then hit the highway again. I think it's a premise that for us drivers who are selective, it would be a wonderful thing. I really would like to have that. Or perhaps I need to hire one and just keep him in the trunk of my car. And
well,
that way I would just always
too.
Have a
I don't know.
Give him a thermos of hot chocolate and say, okay, Mr. Ferguson, well, I hope you're comfortable. I hope you use the men's room. Okay, climb into the trunk. There you go. Okay, yes, I've drilled a hole there for air. And then we'll see you in 3 hours. Okay, bye-bye. And then off we go on our merry adventure with George Maharis and everything like Route 66. we're not going to talk about I don't want to talk about politics because I know
football. No, I'm done with
Kimberly that. Young is the sweetest person in the world, and she doesn't like talking about politics.
And that's
so fine. I won't bring up a certain doctor's name who is in all the news tonight, a certain woman doctor who has had a come-to-Jesus moment out of nowhere. But I do want to I was asked a question by a listener. I'm not going to talk about political correctness, the stuff we're going through right now. But I'm going to – oh, this is a good question. Someone sent me a question, and I want you guys to come up with your answers. Someone sent me a question and said, Mummy, you've moved out of New York City, and you've moved to the suburbs of Philadelphia after living in the city for decades and decades and decades and all the conveniences. And you've praised and loved the suburbs and loved that life there and everything and all of this stuff. What are your pet peeves? So I'm going to mention a pet peeve of mine. I've got about four of them, which is not a lot. One of my pet peeves, and I always knew that we had wonderful water in New York City and even better water on Fire Island. We had the softest water on Fire Island. You would touch a bar of soap and you'd be covered with suds. Your clothes would be immaculate. Your dishes, you'd wash your dishes, there wouldn't be any spots on them at all because the water was so soft. Even New York City's water was famous as being absolutely glorious water. For a major city to have water that wonderful was just incredible. It tasted wonderful out of the tap. It was wonderful water, wonderful. The water here in Philadelphia, it's not the worst water in the world. It's not the hardest water. God knows what it is, Wayne, but it is. It's the hardest water I have ever lived with. You wash your dishes, and they have white spots all over them. So I have to spritz everything with distilled water out of my plant spritzer. When I'm done washing dishes, I spritz them with that. I don't water any of my houseplants out of the tap. None. Mm-hmm. I do it all with distilled water. So I have had to do distilled water on everything. And I've got to tell you, we squeegee our shower stall because if you don't, there's white film all over it. And so when you're done with your shower, you take a wonderful window washer squeegee and squeegee the glass doors and the glass walls and everything, because otherwise it just looks like, you know, a filmy, strange thing. And the water is hard. When you taste it, when you wash your hands in it, when you wash your body, it's not dreamy like Fire Island water or New York City water. So that is a regional pet peeve of mine, and if we owned this house, I would call the Culligan man and have him install a soft water system because it would be wonderful to have that. Of course, your plumbing is ruined here, so people with pipes here, they know their home plumbing is being gradually destroyed by the water. You know, it's being clogged up and everything. So anyway, let's go around the table. Kim, you moved to Kansas. Yes. What is your pet peeve about Kansas? What would you trade away for something else in a different part of the country? It can be anything.
Oh, gosh. I can't say that. I was going to say something political. Let me think. Well, you know,
you want to think about it for a minute?
I wouldn't mind having a few more hills, you know, pretty flat around here for the most part.
Oh, yes, that's true. Because we basically live, even though we're outside of Philadelphia, we live on a mountainside. Our community was literally chiseled out of a mountain. So we are surrounded. I had forgotten that about Philadelphia. But, you know, you think, well, Philadelphia, come on. But we're surrounded by foothills of mountains. I mean, this is mountainous around here. And I love that about where we live. Love that. I would have a lot of trouble living in flat area like that. I lived in Ohio for a long time, and it was way too flat. I'm someone who does like topography. I love topography. So, yeah, makes perfect sense. Wayne, what about you?
Oh, let's see. Well, first off, I kind of grew up on the suburbs of Baltimore before we moved back to the Eastern Shore, which is nothing more than mud flats and a sandbar. It is flat.
But you do have soft shell crabs.
Oh, I was going to say, no, I'm a big fan. Matter of fact, I had one just Friday night. So, or Saturday, I'm sorry, Saturday. Anyway, long story short, yeah, the Chesapeake Bay Marinecraft, and I love living in Annapolis. The rural aspects is nice, it's quiet and stuff, but you get a big snowstorm, and guess which of the last roads they ever try to plow you out of? Those quaint little backcountry roads.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So that was kind of, you know. So,
but you don't
here,
have that much snow there, do you? I mean, this winter
well,
you
I'll
did,
you
but
what,
not a lot.
We had one before I went up to Ohio, and that would have been 8 years ago. We had like three blizzard-sized storms that came through, and it dumped about 50 inches of snow.
Yeah.
I had a John Deere tractor, and when I say tractor, you know, the rear wheels are about, you know, up to my shoulder with a bucket front-end loader. And like I said, my lane was a third of a mile long. It was like I was clearing it out with a teaspoon.
Oh, my God. You know, well, and you had a rough winter this year. You had a rough winter because we had tons of snow here in Philadelphia. And people, my neighbors were all talking about the fact they had no snow last year. And this year, with us moving here for the first time, they said, oh, my God, you brought the winter with you. You know, it was like you guys had it in Maryland and everything. Yeah. Gwendolyn, what's your pet peeve? Having lived – see, now you're like me. You've lived around the country. So when you move to Florida, different from New York, different from the Northeast, what's a pet peeve of yours down there that you wish you could trade away in Port St. Lucie?
The humidity, honestly.
Yeah.
The humidity. Because it's such a great thing when the summer comes on, and I enjoy the rainy season very much. But when it heats up too much and there's humidity, it's hard. It's hard on me. But I love sitting directly in the sun. That gives me it gives me a great deal of joy. But, you know, the humidity has to be number one for just about anybody. It's the tropics, you know.
It
We're
is
no
funny about Florida
subtropical.
Because, right. It is funny about Florida because when I've been in Miami, you know, when you're on Ocean Drive there and it's wide open and you've got the old Art Deco hotels that have all been remodeled and it's so much prettier and nicer than it was in the 70s. You know, it's amazing that Miami Beach actually got slummy for a while there because it was the most beautiful real estate allowed to become so derelict for a long time there. But after the 80s, and certainly into the 90s and everything, that strip is absolutely breathtaking, except, and you can't understand it because it's like it's wide open. The water is turquoise. The palm trees are there, and yet there's no movement of air at all. It's the weirdest thing when it gets hot and humid in Miami because you're not closed into like the Bowery in New York City with, you know, clothing lines strung between slum, you know, Mott Street tenement buildings. You're out in the open. But when Florida becomes becalmed and humid, it's the weirdest experience. It just is so strange to be in that much heat and humidity with no motion at all. It's a very strange feeling.
It's
unlike
water.
Hawaii completely.
That's why we
I'm
live
sorry,
in
what?
The water. We live in the water. We get in the water. I grew up.
Yes, yeah.
Gee, I was swimming before I was walking right. I mean,
yeah.
Mother threw us
exactly.
in the Pier 66 pool with a little bubble on our back. Learn, kid, learn.
People literally drag their chaises, their beach chairs, out into the water and put them there and then lie in the water. It's the cutest thing because you're literally there with your thermos of pina coladas and you're in like 12 inches, 18 inches of water on your beach thing and you're lying there in the water, allowing the water to break over you as much as it does if there's any movement at all of it. I mean, we had that down in St. Barts. The last time we were in St. Barts, we simply dragged our beach furniture into the water and there were no waves were not breaking. It was like a lake, except it was called the Atlantic Ocean. It was called the Caribbean, mm-hmm. and it was a lake, and it was still, and you were lying in your chair in the water, and it was just the strangest feeling. I learned a secret there, too, which was to wear clothes into the water. So instead of being in as little clothing as possible, I would wear a T-shirt and Bermuda shorts and get them wet, because somehow it would wick, the water would be cooler. Somehow it made you cooler to have wet clothing on in the water than to be naked. So it was the weirdest kind of experience. It was a very strange thing to be taught that. It's like, no, don't wear a swimsuit. You put a white T-shirt on and, you know, your shorts, and, you know, kick off your flip-flops up on the sand and then go into the water and lie down on a chaise and have the water washing over you, sort of like in a sitz bath, and then the nice waiter will come over with another pina colada for you, and, you know, eventually you'll pass out, and at sunset a hotel team will come and wheel you ashore and drag you away or whatever. It was really strange.
It's the evaporation that has the cooling aspect for you. Like you said, the wet shirt, as that moisture is being evaporated off, it's actually taking your body heat with it. So
it's strange. That's very strange.
When you're at the ocean, you swim in the ocean, you have to dive down and the water gets real cool. And if you swim underwater for a little while, your body temperature falls. And then you go back and sit in a chair, and it's nice. And you can actually feel, even if there isn't any, a breeze or something, because you're cool.
Meanwhile, the three of us are talking about this, and poor Kim is stranded in the middle of the prairie.
She has dust storms.
I think that we should collect some money and buy postcards of famous ocean places and mail them to Kim, and she can put them up on a bulletin board just outside her garden and make it like, oh, this is what it would be like to be near water. It's like, oh, my God, I miss the fact that Philadelphia and the suburbs that I'm at, you know, I always was aware that New York City was an ocean city, and most New Yorkers don't think of that. They don't really think about it because they're surrounded by 80-story buildings, but every once in a while, the wind shifts, and you would smell salt air all the way in Hell's Kitchen, all the way in Times Square, and you'd look up and you'd see seagulls, and it was like, oh, for heaven's sakes, I forget, this New York City is an ocean city, and the air would come up from, you know, the Verrazano Narrows area, and it would come up the Hudson or up the East River, and you would smell that salt ocean air, and you'd see the seagulls, and you go, oh, that's right, this is an ocean city. Of course, no chance of that with Philadelphia or where I live now, but, you know, I miss that. Whatever. I'm looking at the time, and we are out of time. I would like to thank Kim, it's wonderful you called in. You're like my garden goddess, and it's wonderful to hear your voice. And I hope you're having a happy, happy spring.
You too. I love you.
Well, we love you. And by the way, for those of you that don't know, Kim works in the medical profession. She is a nurse. And so she is a hero and has been a hero above and beyond the call of duty for over a year now. And when we were clanging our pots and pans at 7 o'clock every evening, Kim, every time that we did it out on West End Avenue at 7 o'clock, and people would throw open their windows and start banging their pots and pans and ringing their bells and their gongs and everything, I always, always, always sent you my prayers and my warmest wishes and my thanks and my gratitude, because you are yet another one of those heroes that stuck with it when, you know, we couldn't even have people at the top of our country being heroes about it. You were being a hero. And so I know I give you our thanks from all of us and all our listeners. Anyone working in the medical profession was a frontline worker during this disaster. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
My pleasure.
And Wayne, I want to thank you for calling in today, too, so much. Thank you.
You know, this is very entertaining, and I just thoroughly love your show. I dearly love Gwen, as we all do. And Yeah, it's a very, very good show. I encourage many more to tell your friends. This is fantastic.
Thank you. And Gwendolyn, you are a fabulous producer, and I want to remind everyone that our show is brought to you every week here, Monday nights, 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, 7 Central, or your corresponding time zone. And our sponsor every week is DaughtersOfIsis.com, the fragrant memories of our ancestors, and by listeners like you. We will look for you again next Monday night. Please tune in, 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time here on the Here Be Monsters studio with Come Now, Don't Sulk. This is Sybil Brunson signing off from Blog Talk Radio Network. Good night, everybody.
Good night, all.